Hello and welcome to ESPN Cricket Info's Talking T20 podcast. My name is Alex Malcolm and today we will dissect the extraordinary finale to the Big Bash League in Australia with a very special guest. The Melbourne Renegades won their first BBL title in dramatic fashion after crosstown rivals the Melbourne Stars lost 7 for 19 in 30 balls, having seemingly been in complete control of the final. Joining me is ESPN Cricket Info's associate editor and author of a new book, Bradman and Packer, The Deal That Changed Cricket. Dan Bredig, hello.
Terrific to be here.
And ESPN Cricket Info's BBL columnist and a member of the Great Cricketer podcast, Sam Perry. Nice to see you.
You too, Alex.
And we are very lucky to be joined by a special guest today, the proudest man of Victoria, I reckon. He's building a coaching CV that's almost peerless in Australian cricket, and on the back of winning his first BBL title as the coach of the Melbourne Renegades last Sunday. Andrew McDonald, congratulations and welcome.
Thanks for having us, Alex.
Thanks for joining us. You're in a bizarre scenario as we record this, 4 days on from winning a title, a euphoric moment, a great achievement for you and your group, and yet 2 days out from preparing a Shield team for a Shield match on Saturday. Have you had a chance to actually sit down and absorb and reflect what you achieved?
Probably not as yet in its entirety. We've sort of seen bits and pieces of the replay, but as is the way in the T20 landscape, the show rolls on to a new location, and some of our players are off to the Pakistan Super League. Some of our players have rolled into an Australian series in India, so I really think next time we get the group together is probably the first time we'll be able to appreciate it as a group in full.
Will you get together? Will you try and plan something?
I think we'll plan something with the staff because the staff have been left behind, so I'm sure that the CEO will come to the party there and might take us out for a nice dinner or a lunch to say thank you. And then obviously when the players come back in next year, there'll be a couple guys missing, as is inevitable with any list and turnover. But we'll probably get the guys back in and say congratulations then. So probably about 10 months' time we'll be able to see a celebration of type.
Do you think the teams over the 8 years of the BBL have gotten a bit better at the transition out of the end of the tournament into Shield cricket, whether they've had a really good tournament and celebrating or whether they've had a terrible one and they've got to sort of get their heads back together?
Yeah, I think so. I think first year being involved as a player, it was something new to us and we probably didn't quite get that right. I suppose you almost take the feeling and agitation from the games within the BBL then back into your state stuff, and that used to take a little bit of time to level out. But we come back here on Tuesday and it was all systems go, and Victoria, I think we've got that right over a period of time, and that's probably been evident by our seamless transition back into Shield and pressing for Shield titles in the recent times. But yeah, our guys are pretty good at it, and I think most other teams are now. It's normal for them to play against each other in all different types of competitions around the world. So it's just one big cricketing community, and we call it the circus. It's like the big top, it just rolls on. The same people roll through it, and same coaches roll through it, and yeah, we've got very, very accustomed to it.
This particular fixture, though, Andrew, was quite dramatic, and you find yourself at the helm of the Victorian side now, where you've got players from both sides who've had to come and deal with each other sort of 24 to 48 hours after, you know, a pretty crazy kind of fixture. Like, do you have to give consideration to managing the fragility of the losing side egos versus the guys who are euphoric, and especially given you're on the winning side as well? Do you have to think about that?
You do think about it, and there's the odd barb that's thrown out. I think Chris Tremaine threw one at Sebastian Gotch today. So the banter will continue on. And look, our guys banter over a simple game called soccer volleyball, which we play in the warm-up, and that probably creates more controversies and fallouts than any game of cricket can. So, look, yeah, there's always those moments where there's some fallout. I think the game was pretty clean on Sunday. I don't think there was too much to fall out. I think the Stars were in shock, and as you said, we're pretty high. And they may have felt as though they lost it as opposed to us winning it. But I think that sort of discredits our group, the way that we played throughout the whole tournament.
I know you've done a few interviews on the final itself. I didn't want to cover too much old ground, but the game itself was just bizarre. How much of it can you put down to luck, good management? You've spoken about Aaron Finch thinking on the fly. What can you put your finger on how it sort of unfolded?
You got to make some things up on the fly, and we do a lot of planning going into games, and we include the senior players within that planning, and a lot of it is around what ifs. What if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? Because most games, if they go perfectly according to plan, then it doesn't need much thinking or require much thinking. And we felt as though that was probably the Melbourne Stars there for a lot of that game, where, you know, Maxie had control. He had funky fields, and, you know, there was guys lining up behind the bowler and straight fields. And I think you can do that when you're totally on top. And at none for 93, they were also on top. That's my phone going off. Sorry, gentlemen. I don't know whether that's a fine in this environment, but
no, it's fine.
Yeah, and And Finchie had to control the scoreboard. He had to make it up. A lot of the what-ifs that we spoke about almost got thrown out at that time as well. And the one thing we said, just control, if you can control the scoreboard at certain times and don't let the run rate get out of hand, you might be a chance if you can get a couple of wickets. And that's essentially what happened. We got a couple of wickets. Finchie was then able to squeeze. I thought he was magnificent in the way he brought fielders up. The box men come right in tight and then the rotation of strike stopped. And then they panicked. And this game is a wonderful game, and it's almost through perceived pressure that they did panic. Like, there was no real pressure on them at that point in time, but as soon as they went four down, then it was real pressure as opposed to perceived pressure. And that's when we probably knew that we were a real chance in the game. And I think it was signified by Mackenzie Harvey taking the catch and Sam Harper. I think he's never ran that quick in his life, and he just streamed straight in there for the hug. And I think that's when I got a sense these guys think they can win this now, and it was a great moment.
I know that in the Stars dugout at the time that Marcus Stoinis got out, there had been a feeling building up for a couple of overs prior to that that we're not icing the game right at the moment. We, you know, it could be all over already, and it's not. And then a wicket falls, and the tension of that collective group was probably seen in the brief innings by Pete Hanscom, and that obviously has a ripple effect because you guys all see that, whether at the side of the field or in the middle, and obviously the Stars see that as well, as like, you know, this is the embodiment of the feeling that's been building up in our group for, you know, the past couple of overs.
Yeah, and I think Glenn Maxwell summed it up in the post-match, didn't he, where he may have questioned whether Marcus had got the timing right and whether he'd pressed early enough. And oh, it's certainly emotions and feelings within the bench. And I mean, this great game, there's so many opinions as to what should happen and what shouldn't happen. And, you know, to pin it on Marcus Stoinis potentially played slow. He did that in a few other games and got them across the line. So sometimes we look in hindsight and say, oh, that should have happened. But I reckon there was four or five games where he actually batted its entirety and iced the game, and his strike rate was only 110, 115. So he gets the applaudits there, whereas though he gets the criticism because they lost. Now, at none for 93, and then 53 off, I think it was 43 balls or something like that. I remember that in my head for some reason. With that batting lineup, still a pretty good chance of winning the game, no matter how slow the opener's gone.
Can you elaborate a little bit on how it was a little bit more than just the Stars losing it from that situation? So you mentioned Finch's fields, etc. Can you just describe for us like some of the great things he did tactically or bowling-wise that did bring you back into the game that weren't necessarily about perhaps batting mistakes?
Yeah, well, we believe that with our batting and our bowling, that our last sort of five or six overs was our great strength. So we believe that Nabby, Christian and Cooper as finishers, and we believe that Richardson and Gurney, we had the two best death bowlers in the competition. I think statistically that's probably proven. So we always feel as though if we can get the game deep in terms of a bowling sense and the run rate's 8 or 9 and over, that Gurney's an absolute nightmare to line up, and suddenly you've got 10 and over for the other bowler to bowl to. So we always believe that that was our great strength, and it was almost like we had to get through the first six overs of an innings, and then our game started. And that's where we've struggled to really piece it together throughout the tournament. We made some changes. Nabby bowled in the first six. We had different bowlers roll through there. But we always believed with Gurney and Richardson that we had the back end locked down. So I think that gives you a belief. So you're almost like, if we can get to that situation, if we can get to five or six overs out and we've got Gurney and Richardson up our sleeve, then we're going to take some beating. And that's what we did throughout the whole tournament. And that's what we believed that we could do. And lo and behold, that happened. And yeah, so that's why I say that sometimes, yes, opposition are perceived to lose the game. However, that was our great strength. They didn't blow us away in the first 10, 12 overs, and I think that's what Maxie was disappointed about.
How did your bowlers find adjusting lengths from the semi-final to the final? Because the semi-final, the track was unbelievably good, and guys were just getting whacked if they missed their length fractionally. Earlier in the tournament, guys were bowling back of a length, top of off stump, and it was very hard to score, and then suddenly it went back that way in the final, certainly when it slowed up later in the afternoon. How did your guys adjust to that from Friday night to Sunday?
Yeah, well, Friday night we were too wide. We bowled poorly Friday night, in particular in the first 10 overs. And probably the back 10 overs against the Sixers is the reason why we got an opportunity at the final. With 80 runs conceded in the back 10 overs of a game when a team's one for 100, and not many people talk about the moments to get you there, and that was an incredible comeback. We're staring down, I reckon, 210, 215. quite comfortably if they got it half right. So we were a little bit wide in that first 10. Our bowlers are great self-reflectors. They took that on board. Didn't get a chance to train it with a one-day turnaround, but mentally they got their heads around bowling a lot straighter, and we saw that we bowled a lot straighter in the final. The final wicket, because it was daytime, may have been a little bit different, but it presented very similar to what it was. But I think just in the daytime, it was a little bit slower and didn't slip on as it does at night time.
One thing, obviously, that's part of your setup is the, you know, the analytical side of it, whether it's using CricViz or whatever. How much of that is useful within a game, or is it more sort of what you're setting up with going into a game? Like, guys aren't necessarily thinking about that out in the middle.
Yeah, it's big in the preparation build to a game, or the preparation phase. In game, you don't have the time to use that, and we don't encourage that as a coaching unit. Our job is to prepare the players, and basically there's a handover to the captain, the senior players, and the individual players as to this is what may happen, this is what the data can suggest. And a lot of players don't see the data. It's really Aaron Finch, Dan Christian, and Tom Cooper that see that, and it's up to us to filter it down, because a lot of players don't really need that. All they need to know is, okay, what's your role? Where am I going to bowl? How's it going to unfold for me? So we don't want to overload the players with data, but we definitely recognise that in the back room. And the great thing about this game is a lot of the time the eye test tells you what's happening anyway. So 10%, we challenge ourselves on that 10% where the data can potentially help us. So we, after Friday night, went, oh, geez, we think we're a little bit wide. You know, the hands were flowing through the ball. Philippi was getting a hold of us through cover point. So generally speaking, yeah, maybe we are a bit wide. And you go back to the data just to make sure that you're not seeing something that's not there. And in particular with the viewing positions that we have at most Big Bash games, which is side on ground level, not great viewing.
One thing off the back of that I wanted to also talk about was the ability of someone like Cameron Boyce to adjust his bowling within a game and within a spell. Because if you look at both the semi and the final, I think it was none for 20 odd off two overs in each of those cases. And certainly in the example of Josh Philippi, I think, where, just as you said, you know, he was being given space to free his arms, excellent over and through cover, but to straighten up his line and get the miscue that way, does that reflect, I suppose, a mature bowler able to adjust within a game?
Oh, 100%. And that's the thing. It's about experience, and people talk about experience. He would have seen that situation before. He's gone, Philippi's freeing his arms, I need to tighten him up, maybe need to go a bit quick with the ball speed. If I'm going to go slower, go higher and wider. And the other thing to take into account there was the first time that he bowled none down to both opposition, and that allows them to attack that spinner outside the power play. And that was probably the first time or second time in the tournament that happened to him. So his ability to take that pressure, accept the fact that he was going at 10 and over early, and then to drag it back, and I think within it was 2 for 33 or 4 and 2 for whatever, and like the last two overs of both spells went for less than a run a ball, which is incredible. And I think the 17th over against the Sixers went for 3 runs when they were 2 or 3 down. It was incredible stuff, and great nerve, great bottle, just to be able to compose himself and deliver and execute, and that's what makes him a great T20 bowler.
Dan mentioned the data there. I've heard that you are more receptive to it than most, but you do challenge it back the other way. How much did you use data in putting this list together? Because there's some really hand-picked players: Gurney, Shinwari, Nabi. You've talked about Boyce. Obviously, Christian's a wonderful T20 player. How much did you use it, and how much did you go on instinct and the players that you knew?
Oh, a little bit, yeah. You sort of back up your, I suppose, your gut feel with some evidence. And the other thing too is you have a lot of conversations with other players around the world to see what they're thinking. And, you know, Dan Christian with Harry Gurney was significant in that. I played with Harry back in 2011 when we won the T20 title for Leicestershire, so I knew a little bit about him. He had a great tournament there. I think took 24 wickets from 10 games or something. So he's been around for a long time. It was just to see whether he was still up to speed and was the closer that we needed. And when Dan Christian said he's the best death bowler in the world, and we got the data there, both matched up, and it was a no-brainer. And Shinwari was more for the front end. We wanted a bit of ball speed for the start of the tournament. Not many people had seen him, sort of spoke to Mickey Arthur around him. They got a lot of left armers, and that was a key thing with the second overseas spot. We wanted left arm. We'll probably criticise to some degree that there may have been better right arm bowlers out there, but we wanted left arm to allow the captain to have another defensive option. And if you've got continual right armers flowing at a batter that's in, it can be quite easy to line up. So we wanted to create different problems for the batter. So that's why we went left arm. So yeah, use the data, use the word of mouth. And if you can get footage on them too, I think that's, you back your own sort of eyes as to how that may look in your team, and that's probably the most important thing, is to get that footage, have a look, and then try to guess as best you can how that will look in your team when the captain's got to conjure up 20 overs of bowling distribution.
I'm curious about your perspective on continuity within these like T20 franchises. I spoke with Nick Cummins from the Hobart Hurricanes a few weeks ago, who, while they were kind of at the top of the table, was stressing how helpful a one-program approach had been to that franchise. They were a little bit kind of forced into it, given that fewer players want to play in Hobart, but he said that, you know, having most of the guys being from Tasmania with only one or two brought in was really helpful when it came to just kind of swapping the jerseys and making sure, you know, everyone knew each other and got along well and whatnot. Whereas when I listen to you talk, you kind of seem to be very much about finding the right player for the right role, regardless of where they're from. I was just curious about, like, the, you know, your view on the role of people knowing each other within these kind of flitting T20 franchises.
I think it helps. With two teams in the one town, it's quite difficult, isn't it? So you're never going to be able to do that. You're never going to say, oh, we've got continuity because we've got mass numbers of Victorian crickets in our Renegade setup. It's basically 50-50, isn't it? 10 players go to the Stars, 10 players come to the Renegades, and then it's about, okay, what else can we put around that? So your continuity is essentially your Victorian players, and then how many gaps you've got outside that. So ideally, I think continuity is proven to be more successful. So those one team towns definitely have a leg up in terms of they're playing together through the JLT, they're playing together through the Shield, they're getting to know each other, in particular new young players coming in, how they perform, the nuances is the way they go about things, you know, a senior player being able to read the body language of a younger player, you know, under pressure. I think that definitely helps them problem solve in the middle, but it's not to say that it's foolproof or fail-proof.
You mentioned the young players. I wanted to know how you came up with the batting lineup. Convention in Australian BBL cricket is that your most senior players and your best players occupy your first four slots to take the most number of balls. You threw your young players into the fire with a free licence and back-ended heavily with your experienced players and basically asked them to clean up any scenario or any situation that they found themselves in. How did you come up with that, and why do you think it worked?
Well, it was just the personnel we had at the time, and we felt that that was the best order to win games of cricket. And I think we had 10 different opening combinations in the first 11 rounds, and we wanted to be dynamic and flexible and build that in the early rounds. We didn't have a formula that we went, that can win the tournament. So we were searching behind the scenes for what was working for us as well, and we weren't afraid to make some changes and moves. And yeah, we had some senior players that weren't in great form as well, which sort of, you know, can cloud your judgment. If they were in good form, then you can potentially slide them up knowing that you're going to bank on them at the top of the order. And the other thing too is I think that the least amount of pressure is actually at the start of the game. Yes, you are facing the best bowlers, but there's only two men out. And to give a young player some freedom to go about it, I think it's a great thing, and you find out about them and they can play free. And then, as I said, Alex, the senior players are there to potentially pick up the pieces, and they did that magnificently well. And look, we're in some tight situations, and Dan Christian, Muhammad Nabi, Tom Cooper, those guys, you know, found their way through it, and we were backing them to do that as well through their experience.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a baseball comparison there, I suppose, to have, you know, the guy in the cleanup spot and sort of the middle of the order who's almost inevitably going to be coming in with guys on base, and you want someone there experienced to take that home.
Yeah, very similar. You can use that comparison there. But as I said, once we saw it, I think the time that we saw it where we go, that looks right, was the MCG. I don't know whether you remember that partnership against the Stars, none for 51, Mackenzie Harvey, Sam Harper. We're like, geez, do we keep that the same throughout the whole tournament? We had Finch coming back and Harris coming back, so we knew that they weren't necessarily going to lock down those opening spots. So then we had to work out where they then began to fit from there. So we always knew what was coming back from Australia, and we had to work towards what was it going to be our final model to push for the tournament. I think some people find their formula a little bit early, and therefore they can become predictable. And I think the one thing about us is we embrace the fact that we're going to do it differently. And you know, if you're matching up against us as an opposition, we're quite unpredictable in what we did.
Yeah. One thing about Dan Christian, who, you know, obviously we'll discuss in some detail, but I'm struck by his ability that he's accumulated over his 2020 experience to hit that six over point, basically try to hit the wide Yorker for six, which, you know, had been in 2020 cricket considered one of the go-to balls. Can you provide any insight as to how he has worked on that and perfected that, I suppose?
through practice. I think there's a lot of times, if you think back to early in his career, where he failed with that ball, and a lot of batters did. So he went, if that's where they're going to go, I've got to come up with a play for that ball. And he's just moved across the crease. He's almost setting up for it at certain times, predicting what the bowler's going to bowl. And then if it's not quite there, he knocks it in the leg side for a one or a potential run hard for two. But the amount of power that he creates out there is extraordinary. And if they miss, it goes. And that's the other thing too. He executes beautifully. As soon as they miss, it's pretty much six. If they get it right, then it gets squirted out, maybe one or two, whatever may happen from there. But that's a lot of practice. We throw to him a lot of the time out there, and he says, throw wide Yorkers to us, and continually practicing, continually improving. And he's just got great self-belief as well. He backs himself to do anything.
How much did Sam Harper surprise you? His strike rate was unbelievable given how much you played at Marvel Stadium. Did he shock you in what he came up with, or were you thinking that that's what he was capable of?
If I thought he was capable of that, he would have been on the list in the first place, I reckon, in all honesty. Yeah. He got an opportunity through, Harrison and Finch, those guys picked in the test setup. We knew what he could do. He's a Victorian player. Did we know he could do it to that extent or that level or that consistently? Not sure. I think I'd be lying if I said yes. I think he passed 30 some seven times. And as you said, his impact and his strike rate was significant. And what he was able to do is almost relieve the pressure on the guy down the other end. The young player, it was almost them planning for him as to, geez, what are we going to do here? So the senior bloke can sit in. I think that played out pretty much at Marvel with Aaron Finch sat down one end against the Hurricanes, and it was frenetic down the other end, and Finchy just sort of knocked them around, which was rare to see. So it was a real surprise package. And I think the other thing too is that we shouldn't undersell with Sam Harper is his keeping throughout the tournament was quite tight. He missed a stumping, I think it was in the semi-final off Daniel Hughes, but other than that, it was quite tidy on a difficult wicket at times.
Just speaking of individual players, can you give us an insight into Kane Richardson? I mean, T20 is kind of full of a lot of zeitgeist around mystery spinners and raw pace, or guys who can close who have these specific roles. When I look at Kane Richardson, whether the eye's trained or not, I don't really see anything that particularly stands out in terms of weapons that he has, and yet he's consistently one of them, the most, if not the most effective bowler at this level. I mean, what makes him so effective?
I think the way he sequenced an over, we talk about sequencing an over and the ability to read the play, what's happening, read the surface, in particular in that first six overs, the ability to go, okay, it's swinging a little bit, this is the ball I need to bowl, this is where my defences are, because they're coming at you quite hard, and he always has the ability to bowl that slow ball at the right time. And it's not a deceptive slow ball, but it's enough enough disguise there to trick the batter. And at the death, he just executes. And as I said, the sequencing of the over plus the execution makes him one of the world's best, in my opinion. And he's low maintenance too. He's a pleasure to coach and does a lot of his planning himself, and he's quite thoughtful about the game. So he's always planned and prepared, comes into the coach's room, ticks it off with you, and pretty much what he's come up with is what you've got. So he does a lot of that homework behind the scenes, which is probably not seen. And, that homework, I think, prepares him for the ability to sequence the over, and that's one of his great strengths. Certainly not his arm size.
How do you know? I wasn't. Is that part? I mean, did you just give us an insight into how you guys prepare a little bit as well? I mean, do you get your bowlers to come in and compare notes before games with what you would like them to do and then what they would
do? Yes, some of the guys do their own notes. Some of the other guys will sort of leave it up to the coaches to come to them or the captain to come to them. But we do a lot of stuff one-on-one. We believe that the team meetings or the big team meetings that used to happen are gone. It really is about an individual owning what he's going to do within that game, and then that all formulates into a team environment, so to speak. A lot of it's one-on-one. So a lot of the bowlers will get to Dimi Mascarenhas and myself. We sort of take charge of the bowling. The batters go through Lachlan Stevens and Andre Borovic, and it really is individual builds into the game. And it's working well at the moment. I think the players appreciate that as well. We have a small meeting pretty much just to announce the side and announce the opposition, and with a few key words that may be specific to that venue. But most of the time, the guys, as you said, we get experienced players. They know the venues, they know what to expect, and most of them know the opposition. They play against each other a fair bit these days.
Just on that theme, I wanted to ask you about the art of coaching. And a number of your players have spoken about how even you are, both in temperament and keeping the environment calm and composed pre-game, during the week, after a win, after a loss. How important is that to you as a coach, and how difficult is that for you when you will have stressful moments as a coach?
I think that comes down to your coaching team then, doesn't it? I think I've got a really good team around me. You've got Lachlan Stevens, 10-plus years in the game as a coach, and then obviously another 10-plus as a player. He's very calm and level as well, and we just hold ourselves accountable to each other pretty much in that coaching room. Andre Borovic, sensational. Dimmy's very calm as well, Dimmy Mascarenhas. So that coaching unit works well together, and if someone does get a little bit up or down, then we try to level things out. And it's important that we stay level for the players because they are trying their best, even if they do lose. And when they win also, it's, okay, well, we're moving on to the next job. And our job is to prepare the players. Their job is to enjoy the, you know, the wins when they come and make sure they're not too low through the losses. So we sort of believe once that first ball's bowled, albeit sometimes you do intervene in a game, which is very rare, but once that first ball's bowled, we're sort of almost moving on to the next game and our heads is around the next game and what that looks like for us. So that keeps you pretty level because you know that your job actually starts when the game ends.
Two of your biggest management challenges this year with two of your more senior players, Finch and Harris, who had to experience Test cricket back to T20 cricket back to Test cricket, yeah, in Harris's case. And I imagine they would have been a particular coaching challenge for you. How did you handle that with those two guys? They're different characters, different levels of experience. What were the processes you had to go through from both an individual and a team perspective?
I think with Finchie, It was a pretty easy one with Finchie. I've got a reasonable relationship with him, and the fact that he didn't have to go back to the Sri Lankan series made it a little bit different. So his head was fully into the T20, and as captain, he got straight into it. You wouldn't have known that he, you know, had a disappointing Test summer. That's the sort of individual he is, and he loves playing for the Renegades. He's been there since its inception, so he was actually pretty buoyant when he came back into the environment, which was great. Marcus Harris, slightly different, I think. He had his mind pretty much on the Sri Lankan series, which is fair enough, because that's where his headspace was coming out of the Test series against India. And he only had four games maybe in that little break there. So we didn't really put a lot of work into his T20 stuff. We almost just let him off the leash. And I think at the Gabba, he got a 30-odd that was real quick. And outside that, he didn't really perform. But, we always knew that was always going to be a hard work to get him into T20 mindset and then flip him back into Test cricket. So we almost just let him go and you know, fingers crossed, see how he went, and didn't quite work out for him besides that 30 at the Gabba. But you never know whether you get it right. But I sort of entrust Lachlan Stevens. He knows Marcus Harris really, really well, and you know, I'm guided by Lock in that sense. But Finchie was an easy one. I reckon Harry's slightly different, and whether we got that right or wrong, hindsight probably says that we got it wrong to some degree because his numbers weren't great. But yeah, who knows.
One more in terms of the coaching side of it, and I suppose how you've come to it. How much of the way that you do it is derived from the coaches that you had, as opposed to I suppose you finding your own way once you'd finished playing, or even before you'd finished playing, given that there was a bit of a sort of grey area period there, wasn't
there? Yeah, there was. I was still playing while I was coaching. I think for the Thunder, I had one more year to accept or to do there. But I think a lot of it does. A lot of your ideas are formulated throughout your career, and you do critique coaches when you're playing. You go, oh, that was good, that wasn't so good, maybe they could have done that differently. So you're always doing that. And one of the exercises my mentor got me to do when I first sort of embarked on the coaching journey was to write down what you liked from coaches and what you didn't, and really just write a profile on each coach that you had throughout your career. And by the end of it, you had a lot of coaches as well. So, and you try to take those good parts, you try to understand, oh, hang on, what was he trying to achieve there? Was that a bad part, or was it just bad because I wasn't picked at that time or I wasn't in the team? So yeah, you definitely are shaped by your environment. And you get shaped every day. You've got a different challenge on your hands. With every playing group, I had different challenges at Leicester that probably shaped what I am here today at Victoria as well. So I think until you actually get into coaching, you have no idea what coaches do. That's the one thing I've learned. I think that as a player, you assume to know what they do. Then once you go to the other side, you go, wow, now I get it. Okay, I was a bit hard on that coach, wasn't I? That's a lot of work there. So there are parts that you don't understand, and I don't think players should understand that either. I think that's one of the great. I think great coaches almost, separate that sort of stuff or that chat within the playing group, so the players don't know. I think Greg Shipper did that quite well.
You were able to as well, I suppose. Well, you have to. You have to broaden from. I mean, your view of a coach as a player is, what do I need from that person, and what do I need to learn to ask them for, kind of thing. But then, when you're finishing, you're then projecting much wider to an entire squad of guys, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. And you've got different personalities within that. And as you said, as a cricketer, when you're playing, you don't realise at the time, but you can be quite selfish, and it's about you and your preparation. And look, sometimes you captain side, so therefore it might be another, you know, 10 or 11 guys outside of that at that time. But essentially it's about you getting your preparation right. And then as a coach, it's about, you know, 32 players that you've got to look after. And it's not only that, you've got your coaches as well, you've got your support staff, and then you've got to manage up as well. So, there's a lot to do, and it's a good job. I wouldn't have it any other way.
How much do you draw upon in terms of helping guys with their preparation, the great players that you played with? You played with some amazing players in the IPL. Dele, Warner, Sawag, De Villiers, Collingwood, RCB, Gale, Coley, Vittori, Christian. How much do you draw upon what you saw in those environments and passing that knowledge on to some of your younger players here?
Well, you do. And I mean, every great player's got a story, but I really encourage our players to be themselves and not try to be other people. And I think that sometimes in coaching, you can have this perception on what you think the game should be, and you coach players to what you think it should be. And if we did that, especially during these IPL years, you wouldn't see the array of strokes that we have today. And I think it's scary sometimes to go, well, you should do it this way, you should do it that way. The ability for a coach to draw that out of the individual and get the best out of that individual, the way they move, their mechanics. You know, everyone's got different DNA in terms of, you know, their athletic ability as well. So everyone's going to do it differently. And we've seen that with bowling actions over time. We've seen that with batters. So really, as a coach, especially at our level, we're not in that development space. We get the finished product to some degree. Yes, we've got some younger players coming through, but essentially the way that they move is probably who they are. I remember being an 18-year-old batsman, I didn't look too much different when I was 28 to when I was 18. I think what it improved is my decision making and the ability to read the game and the situation. So we really encourage our players to be themselves and be accountable for the way that they want to play. And we'll help them along the way. And look, if it's fatal, then obviously you've got to step in. You're not going to watch someone fail in front of your eyes continually. But with the great players, it's almost like they've got a sense of, I'll do it my way and be accountable to that. And that's the one message I think for any young player, I think they should take on board.
Really, curious about that, because what you're talking about there is having the capacity to embrace difference, which I don't think is a personal view that Australian cricket has been really great at for a couple of generations. What's your observation around where Australian cricket is broadly, you know, in terms of being able to appreciate that people are different and execute their skills differently? Do you still think there's still a few people out there who want to kind of retrofit our cricketers into what we perhaps should be, rather than just embrace who they actually are and encourage that?
Oh, I think it happens, yeah. And I think coaches are probably the worst of that, aren't they? They sit there and go, this is the way you should bat. Hang on a second. Everyone does it differently. So I think you're right there to some degree. And that's not that's not the whole of the Australian cricket system. I think it's just individual coaches within a framework. And I'm sure that the AFL, the NRL, that'll all happen in that space as well. But, yeah, I think the game gets better every day, and we should allow these young players to explore and take the game forward. And as I said before, if you sat back in, I think 2003 was when England brought in T20, and 2008 was, you know, IPL, and I think that was a great moment in cricket, the IPL, where all these differing opinions and differing ways of doing things come together and converge. And I think the game accelerated then, and I reckon it was more through the players talking to each other as opposed to coaches. So I think sometimes if you coach a certain way, you might be limiting your genius at your hands just because you believe that the game should be played a certain way. So you really got to be careful as to your messaging and what you put, where you believe the game should go.
One thing that we've heard you talk already about vis-a-vis the BBL is that you feel that the number of games is right, but the time frame could be shortened and be a bit more disciplined. Potentially that would mean a little bit more creative use, I suppose, of your fast bowling resources, because guys can't necessarily play every game. But what else, given your experience of the tournament, do you think could change or needs to improve? Whether it's obviously there's the clubs and the broadcasters are both interested in freeing things up a bit, perhaps in terms of overseas players, the scheduling. You know, maybe it needs to be a little bit more, I suppose, partisan, as in, like, in each market, you know, allowing each team to have a consistent run of games at home, things like that. But what else is on your mind?
Where do we start now? I think the competition as a whole has been a success. I think the time frame it's well documented. I think we had a 7-day break, a 6-day break, and a 7-day break at the back end of the tournament, which made no sense whatsoever. So it was a magnificent achievement for the players to have those gaps and go out and still perform. But, I mean, we shouldn't be sending players back to their home port middle of the tournament or at the back end of the tournament to give them 4 days off because, really, we don't want to train them. There's no point in training. They're up and running, and it didn't make much sense that. So I think the length of the tournament, I think we get a bit more creative around that. I think what we've learned also is when we go into February, the crowds are going to drop. We were concerned about pre-Christmas being where the crowds drop, but the crowds actually comparative to February were really good pre-Christmas. So maybe that pre-Christmas slot, we can fill that up a little bit more with some success in terms of the people coming out. And most of my views are around the TV audience has been fantastic, but my view is to get the people through the gates. And I think that's where the players really appreciate BBL, when the young families walk in and there's a crowd there to play in front of. Three overseas, I reckon, would be a start. I think the depth of Australian cricket's been tested at the moment with 8 teams. So there was some talk, I think, of, 10 teams potentially down the track. I would say steady on with that. Get 3 overseas in each team. And then really making the Australian players available. How can we do that? And I think next year looks a little bit better with the scheduling. I think the international calendar at this stage is looking like it's going to end, I don't know whether I'm allowed to say this, but somewhere around sort of January 15. So we're probably going to have a month of all Australian players being available at the back end, which is really, really exciting. So that's another one to take in. And then, I mean, the pitches have been talked about, the surfaces have been talked about, but when you take cricket away from the major venues, you're always going to have that challenge of the surfaces. So do we take it away from the major venues? Do we invest in the infrastructure? I think Maui come up really, really well in terms of the outfield out there. So they spent a lot of money, the government out there. Alice Springs was meant to be there, didn't get up because of the outfield. I think that's a poor reflection. I think Cricket Australia need to look at that. If you're going to take the games on the road, make sure you're putting in the money to make sure that they're viable. And to have a late change from Alice Springs back to the Adelaide Oval, I think was poor. And I think there was about 5,000 people that turned up. So I think that was a really poor result. But don't mind the out venues, but let's invest the money into that. Other than that, I think it's not too bad, and I think it's been talked down a lot more than it probably should have been this year.
How, just on, the only other thing I was going to ask about the overseas players, a bit of talk about a marquee fund. How do you, how much of the clubs discussing with Cricket Australia at the moment how that could work? Because obviously there's been, I suppose you'd say, ad hoc marquee funds in the past in terms of certain players going to certain clubs. May be another club in this state rather than
Shane Warne, Kevin Peterson. Okay, a little bit of a boost there for the first 7 years.
Yes, but what's a more equitable way to do that?
Oh, I think the only way you could do that if you had a marquee, and they're talking to us essentially. So everyone's talking. Our CEO is talking to us as coaches. That's been fed back up to Cricket Australia. So everyone's talking. They've identified that there is a problem or a potential problem if we don't get it right going forward. I think the only way to do it was to have, I suppose, 8 marquee spots available, get 16 players from around the world to nominate, and then you have a marquee draft and just have a lottery draft. So pull, stars out of the hat first and whoever out of the hat second, and then you pick 8 players, 8 marquee players, and those marquee players have to sign up for the entirety of the tournament. And I don't know what money that would take or cost, but yeah, I think that's probably the only way to do it. You can't change the rules and regs on list management now, because some of the teams have signed up overseas for a couple of years, so you've got a problem there. So I think it has to be a marquee player that comes in from outside the cap, and it's a draft, a lottery draft. As to how that operates or works, I'm not sure.
And just the last crystal balling one, the final series, go to a qualifying and an elimination, a prelim, one more game.
Oh, I think we've been calling for that since the inception of BBL. So, it doesn't make much sense. I think Hobart rightfully will be thinking that they were probably the best team in the regular season. They have one bad night. Matthew Wade gets out early. Darcy Shortshanks won in the power play, and suddenly their season's over. I think that's a little bit unfair. So I think that, for one extra game, the tournament's going long enough now. For one extra game for the first and second ranked team to get a second chance, I think makes a lot of sense.
As objectively as you can, how does it compare to the IPL and the England T20 Blast as a tournament?
I think the IPL's the number one competition in the world. I think anyone that's been there, fortunate enough to be there, participate or even commentate or write articles around, understands that that's the biggest competition in the world. Outside of that, I think there's a few competitions vying for second favouritism. The new 100 ball comp that's coming up will be interesting to see where that sort of fits in and how popular that is. But I think BBL at the moment, potentially in the world market space, with a lot of the marquee players going to the PSL and the Bangladesh Premier League, might be seen to be sliding down. But I still think the domestic depth at the moment's okay to warrant it to be maybe ranked 2 or 3 in the world. I think I've got to say that politically, haven't I? But but it's got some work. And I think the one thing Dan was saying before around the overseas and how we the reason why we're having these discussions is because we feel as though we're potentially sliding. So we need to do something about it.
You've been tremendous with your insights. One question I did have was the fans, the media, they have a particular view on how T20 is played, and a lot of it's quite archaic. Is there something you could provide us, people listening, that they should be looking out for in a T20 game and understanding a bit better? Is there something that you watch when you watch games just as a punter and listen to commentary or listen to fans and think they haven't quite got a grasp of how the game's being played?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Every team plays it differently. Like, I remember, like, watching Chennai play, and they bowled part-timers in the power play, and they got through it, and then their game started from, you know, the 7th over to the 20th over, and they just limped through the power play, and they won games at the back end. And, you know, you've seen with Hobart, they win games at the front end. I mean, everyone knows if Matthew Wade and Darcy Short get out, then they're probably in trouble. So every team's got a different style. So I think whichever team you follow, understanding their style and how they play, I think would be helpful at times, because we get some feedback as to where we're going right and wrong, and we think we're going okay, and then the fans, you know, critique it. But I think essentially what the fans want to see is they want to see fours and sixes and entertainment, and the understanding of the ins and outs of, you know, changes in batting order or change in selection and all that sort of stuff is an educated guess based upon matchups and, you know, thinking of surface and all that sort of stuff. So we don't always get it right either. So the fan in the front row might get it right more times than we do at times.
You've received some incredible praise this week about your coaching, and rightly so. We're all enthralled by what you've been telling us here. What are your coaching ambitions? How do you feel about what you might be able to achieve moving forward and where you could head?
Oh, no real great thought as to that at the moment. We just got off the track from a Victorian session. We're focused on Saturday, and I know it's a cliche, but I mean, we're sitting top of the table at the moment. And, you know, we won the JLT Cup, and we're looking at the Shield, potentially doing the double. I don't think Victoria's done the double any time when I've been around. I can't remember the last time they would have done that. So that excites us as a group. We've played some good Shield cricket over the last 4 years as well. So, you know, we've got a fantastic group at the moment, strong bowling group, and it's probably our window to cash in on the depth that we have in the squad. I mean, we had 28 players on the track today. It's the first time that we've had all our bowlers fit post-Christmas, so we feel as though we're well positioned for a big press at it. So, yeah, my coaching ambitions are, simply put, short term.
Well, we thank you very much for your time. Congratulations again. It was a wonderful achievement. You're doing fantastic things both with Victoria and the Melbourne Renegades, and best of luck for the future.
Thanks for having us, guys.
That wraps up our ESPN Cricket Info Talking T20 podcast. My thanks to both Sam and Dan for their input. That wraps up our coverage of the BBL on ESPN Cricket Info this summer. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll speak to you again soon.